This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. During the disastrous snowstorm on Mount Everest in 1996, Dr. Kenneth Kamler was on the mountain taking care of survivors. That was one of several climbs he's made as an expedition doctor on Everest. He's treated extreme frostbite, snow blindness, and altitude sickness, and has risked his life to save others. He's conducted research on Everest in conjunction with National Geographic and NASA. Dr. Kamler is also a hand surgeon. He directs the Hand Treatment Center in New Hyde Park, New York. He's the author of a memoir called Doctor on Everest, Emergency Medicine at the Top of the World. Terry spoke with Kenneth Kamler last December. She asked him how good a climber you have to be in order to work as an expedition doctor.
Well, of course, that depends on what mountain you're climbing.
Good point.
Yeah, on a mountain like Everest, you have to be, a very accomplished climber to even get started on the mountain. It's a very technically difficult mountain, and many of the difficulties come right at the beginning. So if you want to be an effective doctor, you have to be up where the problems are, which are high up for the most part, and you can't even get there if you're not able to get past the first barriers, which come lower down.
And the problems are high up because that's where the oxygen thins and where the air pressure changes.
Yeah, if you think about it, the summit of Everest is 29,035 feet. That's about the same height as the cruising altitude for a transatlantic jet. So there's only about a third as much oxygen as there is at sea level, and your body can't burn fuel efficiently at that height. So your metabolism is sort of like smoldering instead of burning, and you can't give yourself enough energy, so it's easy to get into trouble at that altitude.
What are some of the medicines you pack with you when you're working as an expedition doctor?
That's a difficult problem. It's like Everest itself. The challenge of packing medicine is daunting if you don't take it one step at a time. So I try and think of every injury I might encounter and every problem I might run into. Then I list every supply I would need for it, from cardiac stimulants to adhesive tape, because if I don't bring it, I don't have it, and I have no chance of getting it. But even more subtly, I have to consider the quantities which I have to bring, because in climbing, weight is critical, and I have to limit my supplies, recognizing that I might run short in a major disaster. And as you go up the mountain, you can take less and less. I started base camp with about 4 yak loads of supplies, but by camp 2, which is 4,000 feet higher, I'm reduced to just a fishing tackle box worth of equipment. And then higher than that, I just take what I can put in a plastic bag and keep inside my pocket. Medications freeze. If I don't carry them right against my chest, they'll be frozen and, for the most part, unusable.
What are some of the main differences in how the body works high on a mountain compared to how the body works at ground level?
Yeah, the biggest problem is with the lack of air. There's only one-third the air pressure as there is at sea level. And since metabolism depends on burning oxygen, you don't have that ability. And it's, as I was saying before, it's like a smoldering fire. So your metabolism is very low. Plus, at that altitude, temperatures can run 40 degrees below zero or even colder. And you can have winds that can be up to 40 miles an hour or more. You're so high up that you're actually exposed to the jet stream. So you're dealing with wind chill factors that you'd only find on the surface of Mars, maybe. And added to that, you're at the summit after several days of relentless climbing. You've probably had very little to eat or drink. You've had maybe half a bowl of warm water on summit day when you start out. And you'll be out for 16 or 20 hours that day. It's a very, very long day. And you'll be burning 12 to 15,000 calories, which is about 10 times your normal amount. So you're really on the edge of survival there. And to give you an idea of just how thin the margin of survival is, I remember on one of my own summit attempts, I was carrying a water bottle inside my down jacket against my chest. And as I was coming back from the attempt, I wanted to take a drink of water, and I reached inside my jacket, and my water bottle was frozen. So you really see how thin your margin of survival is there.
Gee, remind me to climb a mountain on my next vacation.
I wonder myself what I'm doing there sometimes.
What's breathing like that high up?
Well, as you get higher, it gets harder to breathe. At that height, it's essentially taking one step and then several breaths and then one more step and then several breaths. It becomes extremely laborious to breathe. Breathing requires muscle power, and you get to the point where the muscle power required to breathe uses up more oxygen than what you're taking in. So it becomes a law of diminishing returns. In fact, the summit of Everest is physiologically just about man's limit as to where they can breathe.
What's the impact on your ability to think clearly and to remember things when you have so little oxygen getting to your brain because the air is so thin? Does it make it difficult for you to function well as a doctor?
Yes, it does. I'm called upon to make some critical medical decisions, which are complicated enough in a modern hospital intensive care unit. And I'm often in a situation where I'm not getting enough oxygen myself, and it's very cold, and the cold is sort of debilitating as well. So you often have a situation where it's hard to think clearly, and sometimes it's literally confusing to figure out how to tie your shoes. That becomes a problem, much less making difficult medical decisions. But I find that I'm aware that I'm thinking slowly. It's not like I'm hallucinating. I'm very aware of the situation. I'm aware I'm thinking slowly, and therefore I can just sort of concentrate and focus, and I find I can get the job done, even though it's a little harder than would be at sea level.
So what happens if you need a doctor?
Yeah, that's what people often say to me up on the mountain. The people I climb with are very experienced, and they very often do climb without doctors on other expeditions. So many of them do have a good deal of medical experience. Some of them are emergency medical technicians, and they've had a lot of firsthand experience. So I think that they would be able to take care of me in an emergency situation.
Dr. Kenneth Kamler talking with Terry Gross. His memoir is Doctor on Everest, Emergency Medicine at the Top of the World. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back now to Terry's interview with Everest expedition doctor Kenneth Kamler.
You were an expedition doctor in 1996 during the storm on Everest, in which so much has been written and filmed about. Where were you during the storm?
Yeah, when that storm hit, I was at 24,000 feet, which is what we call Camp 3. And the climbers who got in trouble were 2,000 feet above me at Camp 4. They had just gone for the summit that day. And we were in our camp below them, listening on the radio as to what had happened to them. And we had heard that they had summited in the afternoon. But even though there was some celebration on their part, it made us all very nervous because they had summited very late in the afternoon. It's a good rule to make sure you have enough daylight to get back, with plenty to spare. And they had summited about 2:30 in the afternoon, which was a very late time to be coming down. They only had a few hours of daylight left and no margin for error. And at that point, we were just sort of hoping they'd get back down. But a storm came up, and unexpectedly, the mountain was just engulfed by the worst, most intense storm I've ever seen. And we knew that they were still out high above their camp, which would have been their shelter. So we were quite nervous about them, and it got dark, and we still had no word that they were back. And in fact, they did not get back. They were stuck out in that storm, and they were unable to get back to their tents. So I was at Camp 3 at that point, which was a place where I could, I would be unable to even treat anybody. We were 2,000 feet below them. They were almost inaccessible to us, but our strongest climbers risked their lives to go up and try and rescue them. And two of our climbers did make it up to the area where most of the climbers were, and started doing what they could for first aid. Where I was, I could radio advice, but we realized we'd have to get the survivors back down if I was going to treat them at all. There was no way that I could get up to that height, and there would be nothing I could do for them at that height anyway. So,
what did you do to prepare in the hopes that climbers would come down, knowing that if they did come down, they would need help?
Well, I was at in a place where I was on a 45-degree icy slope. It's just a notch cut into the mountain. The camp is really, it's just enough room for a tent, and you can't even stand up without roping yourself in. It's bitter cold. Everything freezes. I had very little equipment with me. I just had that plastic bag worth of supplies. My supplies were 2,000 feet lower down. So we felt that if we could get the survivors down to the next lower camp, Camp 2, we'd have a much better chance of treating them and keeping them alive. So we worked out a plan where the climbers would have to stay overnight at Camp 4, which was already a dangerous place to stay, but there was just no way we could bring them down that late in the day. So we waited overnight. The climbers did survive overnight, and as they were being brought down by the rescuers, I myself down climbed 2,000 feet to that lower camp. So what I did was I took the New Zealand camp's mess tent, which was the largest tent in the area, and turned that essentially into a little field hospital. I laid out foam mats on the ice and sleeping bags on top of those. We collected sets of dry clothes because I anticipated that the climbers would be soaked and they would have to get out of their freezing clothes. I hooked up IV bags from the tent, which had to be defrosted first in warm water, And we had oxygen tanks. I opened them up, got them ready, put out my bandages, my medications, and I had the Sherpas boil up as much water as we could because I anticipated some severe frostbite. I knew I'd have to warm their body parts.
How many people made it down who you ended up treating?
There were two critical climbers who came down. Beck Weathers, the American climber who got a lot of publicity in the United States, and a Taiwanese climber named Makalu Gao, who was in very similar condition as Beck. They both had severe frostbite and hypothermia.
Well, how did you treat Beck Weathers? Many Americans saw the photos of his extreme frostbite when he came down from the mountaintop. He wasn't expected to live. Go ahead.
Yeah, he was not expected to live. In fact, when we first heard about Beck, we heard that he was dead. That was our first report. He had been found in the snow at Camp 4 and pronounced dead. And our rescuers were tending to the other ones who were still alive when Beck suddenly just appeared out of the whiteout, out of a swirling fog, and he just staggered into base camp. And I remember getting the radio report from one of the rescuers. He said, "Beck is alive, but I don't know for how long." We really weren't sure he'd even survive the night, but he did survive the night, and he was brought back down to us. When I caught up with him at Camp 2, I expected an incoherent, a half-conscious phantom, but he walked into the tent, and he said, "Hi, Ken, where should I sit?" He was really very well-oriented, much better than I expected. So we laid him down on the mat and on the sleeping bag, and we started an IV, and I started to examine him. And he had the worst frostbite I've ever seen, and I've seen quite a bit of frostbite. His right hand and wrist were purple and frozen, and all the way to a third of the way up his forearm. His left hand was also frozen. His nose was just a brittle black crust. It looked as if he would sneeze, he would just blow it away. So the first thing to do was to make sure that he wouldn't die of hypothermia. So we started that intravenous line, but that in itself is a problem because the fluids are so cold at that altitude. They have to first be defrosted, and then you have to make sure they're warm because the last thing you want to do is put cold fluid into someone who's already cold. So we used hand warmers, the kind of chemical hand warmers that skiers might use, and wrapped them around the IV bags to try to keep them warm. Once I was sure Beck was warm enough, we started the process of trying to thaw out his hands and feet. So we had buckets of warm water, and I put his hands and feet in there. It was very difficult to keep the water warm because of the outside temperature being below zero and because of the fact that his hands and feet were essentially blocks of ice, and they would cool the water very rapidly. So we had to keep reheating the water and adding it and measuring the temperature. It was a difficult, very time-consuming job, but the Sherpas, most of whom had never used a thermometer before in their lives, very quickly got the hang of how to do it and sort of took over monitoring the temperature while I could look into their medical condition a little more.
Are there any dangers when you're defrosting somebody's body parts that have frostbite? Are there any dangers in having the temperature being too warm or in trying to defrost them too rapidly?
Yeah, that's a very interesting point that people don't realize very often. I'm dealing with a frozen body part, and when I try to rewarm that, if I do it too quickly, of course, they might burn. They might get burns, and since their hands are not able to feel pain, they wouldn't even be able to tell me. So you have to be very careful about the temperature. And of course, if it's too low, you're not going to be effective. But an even more difficult problem is that if their bodies are not warm, their hearts will be a little bit cool, and cooled heart muscle is very sensitive, and it can react by going into what we call an arrhythmia, a pattern of beating which would not allow blood to flow and can be fatal. So I had to be careful that their body temperature was high enough where their heart was functioning properly, because if I suddenly rewarmed their hands, that wave of cold, of cold blood, which would come out of their hands into their body, could be a shock which could kill them.
So how did he survive your treatment?
Well, he did amazingly well. He did survive, as did Makalu. They lived through the night. I stayed up all night taking care of them, just making sure their IVs were working, making sure they were breathing. In the morning, we were hoping that a helicopter would be able to come to evacuate the two climbers, but the wind was still blowing so hard that there was just no way the helicopter pilot said he could land. So at that point, I had to make a decision as to whether or not I should try to keep them at 21,000 feet in a second day, or whether we should try to evacuate them over the ice. Over the ice evacuation is quite dangerous. You have to go through a lot of crevasses. It's technically difficult, and it would not be me who would be risking his life to evacuate these people, since we would be using our strongest climbers. So I would be asking our strongest climbers to risk their lives to bring down these two sick climbers. But the alternative was to leave them another day at 21,000 feet, and I didn't feel they could survive another day at that altitude. That 21,000 feet is an altitude where cuts won't even heal. And I had two climbers who were so critically ill that I've seen healthier-looking patients die in an intensive care unit.
Why won't cuts heal at that altitude?
There's just not enough oxygen. The body is functioning at its bare limit. The body does what it has to do to keep itself alive, but it has no extra energy, so to speak, to bring about healing. It's the last place you want to have a critical person.
So what did you decide to do?
Well, I knew my decision would be taken without question. So it was a difficult decision, but I felt that we had to get these two climbers out. And I felt we should evacuate them over the ice, even knowing that we'd be risking other climbers. So we prepared to do that. The climbers organized themselves into rescue teams. I packed up the two climbers as best I could, keeping them as warm as I possibly could. And we started out with that in mind, going down the ice fall. We were at 21,000 feet, and we had a stretch to go of 2,000 feet, after which we would enter the ice fall, which is the most dangerous area filled with crevasses. And as we were going down the route, I was trailing behind the rescuers, and I remember thinking how I'm going to manage these climbers when I get them down to base camp, and you know what other problems I might encounter as we went through the ice fall. I didn't realize as we were going that the wind had died down. And all of a sudden, I was startled to hear a noise and then look up and see a helicopter. So the pilot had been monitoring the weather conditions. He noticed the lull in the wind immediately and made a very daring rescue. He came in that lull in the wind and landed in a crevasse field and was able to lift out the two climbers. He was flying his helicopter above the limit that was considered safe for that helicopter. He was at 19,000 feet. The limit of the helicopter was 17,000 feet. But he risked his life to go higher and bring these climbers out. And in fact, he did get them both out. He helicoptered them out to Kathmandu, where they were in a hospital before we even got back to base camp.
So in what conditions are Beck Weathers and McAloo now, the two people with the extreme frostbite who you treated?
Well, Beck I'm still very much in contact with. He's a pathologist. Lucky for him, it's about the only field of medicine you can practice without hands. Beck, in fact, unfortunately did lose both his hands. He has a prosthetic hand on one side, and he has a kind of a pinching mechanism on the other side. But he is able to function. He's gone back to work as a pathologist. And just like he didn't let the mountain stop him, he didn't let his disability stop him either. As for McAloo, he went to Alaska for treatment. He was in hospitals almost a year. But as he told me, he knew it was time to get back to Taiwan because the doctors in Alaska wanted to refashion a nose for him. And he said he didn't want to have a Caucasian nose. So he headed back to Taiwan, where I haven't heard from him since.
How did the deaths during the storm on Everest and the extreme injuries affect your attitude about climbing again?
Well, when you've climbed all over the world and had a lot of experiences, you always are involved with people who are dying on the mountain. It's not that unusual to have climbers die on the mountain. So it's something that we've all thought about, and we wouldn't be climbers if we didn't sort of accept that risk and understand that that can happen. But having said that, I have to say this was the first time that my friends died on the mountain, and that puts it in a whole other perspective. The risk is no longer abstract. It becomes real. And having a consolation like saying something like they died doing what they love, it suddenly seemed ridiculous. Nobody loves freezing to death. And saying things like we go for the thrill of the climb, it sounds pretty thin compared to the devastation you see in the families of the people who died up there. But the risk is inherent in climbing, and it's actually, I think it's essential for the sport. It's part of the appeal. But it's not an appeal as a daredevil might enjoy it. Because in climbing, you assume a risk that makes you responsible for your actions, and your actions have direct, immediate consequences. It's a kind of a refreshing condition that's often lacking in modern lives where the actions and the effects of what you do are dissipated. And someone like me who goes climbing has to just believe you can control a lot of the risk, keep it within an acceptable limit, although honestly, I'm not sure that taking any risk is acceptable.
Well, Dr. Kamler, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Kenneth Kamler speaking with Terry Gross. His memoir is Doctor on Everest, Emergency Medicine on the Top of the World. This is Fresh Air.